Let's move on to agenda item number 11. City of Santa Barbara Sanitary Sewer Collection System. Mr. Briggs?
Thank you. The board, as we just saw in item, whatever it was, 7, the board always receives our enforcement report, which chronicles violations, including overflows from sewer systems that are reported to us. And a few months ago, I guess it was, you noted that there seemed to be a higher number from the City of Santa Barbara collection system than, say, from some other municipalities. And so in consideration of the fact that we're going to be meeting here in Santa Barbara this month, you asked for an update on the city's actions to try to prevent those overflows as much as possible. So we provide this summary report, which gives you a rundown on the number of spills and what they've been doing. And Ryan Lodge of our staff has prepared this report and has a few words to say before we hear from the city.
Yeah, good morning, members of the board. Ryan Lodge, Water Board staff. I mean, I was at the February 2009 board meeting. Several board members had questions about the number of sewer overflows within the city of Santa Barbara. And again, at that time, you requested that the city come forward and present some information. There is a brief staff report in your agenda with information regarding the city's collection system performance. But with specific information, I'd like to introduce Rebecca Bjork, the Water Resources Division Manager for the City of Santa Barbara, and she will provide an overview of the city's sewer system management program.
And Rebecca, thanks for being here. I'll just forewarn the board that, and maybe, hopefully we're on the same page, you're talking about 15 minutes or so for presentation.
Yeah, I'm going to keep it pretty brief.
Okay.
Good morning, Chair Young, members of the board. Thank you for having us here this morning. We're happy to be here to talk to you about our collection system program. We think it's a very progressive program and are a bit disappointed that our results to date aren't showing our progressiveness, but have strong confidence that we will be able to make our results better reflect the progressiveness of our program in the near future. Our collection system is comprised of 277 miles of mainline pipe, which ranges in size from 4 to 42 inches. We estimate that there are approximately 350 miles of private laterals. And this is important to us because, as you'll find out later in the program, many of our problems seem to be related to private laterals. We have 9 lift stations, and we have a very comprehensive sewer maintenance management program, which is comprised of inspection, cleaning, repair and rehabilitation, and replacement of our system. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a few minutes. And we have a sewer lateral inspection program, which I really think is cutting edge. And I want to spend some time talking about that program with you as well, because it's one of the things that's taking a lot of our resources and efforts. Excuse me, wrong way. Our system is primarily composed of vitrified clay pipe. However, the 20% that you see there that is plastic pipe is the 20% that we've replaced within the last 20 or so years. We have had a long-standing commitment to pipeline rehabilitation and replacement. And I have to say that although it's very, very difficult to come up with quantitative results for pipeline replacement, our qualitative results are very significant. We had a pretty good rain last week. We had about 4 inches of rain down here. And historically, when I started with the treatment plant in 1989, we probably would have maxed out our inlet gates. We saw our flows go up to 20 million gallon peak, which also coincided with our normal peak flows, and they dropped off almost immediately. So we certainly are seeing the influence of our 2 decades of work in the system on inflow and infiltration. I wanted to talk specifically today, though, about our system performance as it's characterized by stoppages and spills, and then talk a little bit about capacity and condition issues in our system as well. This is our stoppage history, and I don't expect you see as much data on stoppages from collection systems as you do on spills, but I'm presenting this because we have collected this data. This isn't required by any regulatory agency. It's an in-house metric that we use to measure how well we're doing on maintaining our collection system. And as you can see, in the 84, when we started collecting this data, we were at about 150 stoppages per year. That rose in 1990 to almost 200 stoppages per year. It's also important to note that the period of 89 to 93 was the drought, the Santa Barbara record drought that nearly drained Kachuma, required the construction of our desal plant and the construction of the State Water Project. And the reason why that is relevant is that periods of dry weather cause plants to seek out water, and that one of the forms of that water tends to be roots going into the sewer system. I'd like to also point out that 2007 to 2009 has been a very dry period. Although we've had a couple years of average rainfall, almost all that rain has come in short, high-intensity rainstorms in the months of December and January. But you do not see a similar level of increased blockages during that period of time. So to me, this represents a significant improvement in our collection system operation. Unfortunately, this chart, which shows our spills, does not represent the same story. And I'm going to come back to it in just a minute, but I wanted to chart the two together because I think what we're really looking at here is two different standards for record keeping. The record keeping standards for spill reporting have changed substantially, particularly within the last 3 years with the adoption of statewide waste discharge requirements, which went into effect in 2007. I think that we had a different threshold for reporting before, so to compare historic spills with current probably report more than anything just represents a different reporting level. I don't want to take away from the fact that we think this is a problem. We really are not happy to see this level of spills in our system, and we are going to work very hard to try and address that. In 2007 and 2008, the spills were broken into Category 1 and Category 2. And so that's why the bar graph for those years shows the split like that. But it also puts into context that many of our spills were of the smaller category, and in fact, most of our smaller spills were completely contained and cleaned up.
Rebecca, can I interrupt for a second?
Sure.
Could you describe how you detect and what you define as a stoppage versus a spill?
Sure. A stoppage is any time that there is a blockage in our collection system that inhibits or prevents flow through the system and requires us to go out and do some maintenance to clean it. A stoppage would also be inclusive of a spill. So a stoppage that causes a spill would also be counted. A spill is any time that water comes out of the collection system, out of a manhole, or other appurtenance to the surface.
So a stoppage could be a customer reports drainage problem, but it hasn't yet.
No, this is stoppages on the city-owned system.
Right.
And yes, sometimes that can be the case, that a customer will report a drainage problem, and it may be a slow problem with a slow problem in our line where it hasn't yet hit the elevation of a spill. But if we left it unabated, it probably would.
So if you had a stoppage that wasn't reported by a customer and it's just in your system, how would you know that?
We find some of our stoppages during routine maintenance, Okay. And we're able to clear them ahead of them causing a problem.
Okay.
Unfortunately, we find some of them when we have a reported spill.
Right. Did you have a question?
Yeah. So what is Category 1 and Category 2?
Category 1 are the spills that affect human health and the environment, or have the potential to affect human health and environment primarily. They are spills of 1,000 gallons or more, or spills that make it to a water body of the state. So, and Category 2 are spills that don't meet that definition, smaller spills spills that don't make it to water bodies of the state. So in taking a look in the staff report, you'll note that we're here today because we've had 72 spills between June 2007 and July 2009. And we wanted to take a look at what the cause of those spills were. And we found that actually 45 of them are linked to problems caused by private laterals. These are still our spills. I don't want to say they were private spills. They're not. They're spills from our system. So they're things we need to take care of and address. But it does really help us to focus in where we need to be putting our efforts, which is continuing to work with property owners to address problems from privately owned infrastructure that adversely affects our sewer system. So the leading cause of that is roots, and this is a good picture of what causes it, roots growing from a private lateral into our public system. They grow completely into the system, block it. It blocks our flow, and we have a spill. Plumber's roots are roots that are cleaned out of a line by plumbers, and they try to recover them. However, sometimes they're not successful in recovering those roots. They then flow down our system, typically to a manhole, where they are released to some extent and cause a dam or blockage and can cause a spill. So we've had four of those. And then debris from construction or repair. These are situations where we can actually clearly identify that the debris in the system can be traced back to a sewer lateral repair that was made upstream of the site where the debris blockage was caused, or where there's a construction site upstream that is a likely source of the cause of the discharge of debris. Not debris from our system deteriorating, but debris that's clearly been discharged to our system during the period of construction. So these are all areas that we will continue to target. We have been targeting them, and we'll continue to target these areas for better control.
Yeah, Rebecca, before you get off the slide, and maybe you're going to address this in the next couple of slides, but I'd like to know more about the debris from construction or repair and how you are cross-linking that to your stormwater permit, if you are.
In this case, we're not. Actually, we haven't been cross-linking it to our stormwater permit because this is actually only debris from construction and repair that would be actually discharged into the lateral and into our sewer system. As the board knows, we have a very comprehensive stormwater management program in the city that does manage construction sites within the city as well.
Right, but if you have a construction site that is allowing discharge of construction debris from it, isn't that something that's supposed to be regulated?
It is, and it's an enforcement issue. And one of the advantages that we have as being a city is that we can work with our building department and alert them to this issue and make sure that they're on the lookout for this kind of situation and help us work on addressing it.
Right. And so my question is, where are you at in that process?
Well, quite honestly, we're just sort of coming to the recognition that this is one of the issues. However, I want to clarify. I think most of these debris issues were actually caused by repairs to sewer laterals that were done under our sewer lateral inspection program, which is my next topic, and I wanted to address in some more depth. The city adopted a sewer lateral inspection program in January of 2007, and as I alluded to in my first slide, it's a very comprehensive program. It requires inspection of properties on when there's an expansion of 400 or more square feet, when there's addition of additional plumbing fixtures, if there's a problem noticed in the sewer line when we're doing our routine maintenance and inspection. So the picture that I showed you before, we would send out a notice to inspect and, if necessary, repair the line to the property owner. When there's a spill from the property, when they fail a smoke test, or when there's other reason to believe that the sewer lateral is in poor condition. But I think that one of the really important aspects, or one of the most important or helpful things about our sewer lateral inspection program, is we also have coupled it with an incentive program for property owners. And the intent of this incentive program is twofold. One, to try and get people to proactively come in and to inspect their lines before they have a problem and replace them. And the other is when they have a mandate to replace those lines, because we do. If the inspection shows there's a problem with the private sewer lateral, we do require that the property owner replace it. It helps to soften the blow of the cost of replacing that line. So this program was initiated in January, between that time and October, we have had 1,484 inspections completed. This has resulted in a much increased level of activity on private sewer lateral maintenance and repair, and this is the primary source of those debris blockages from construction that we're finding in our collection system. And it's, you know, also a possible cause of some of our increased blockages from plumbers' roots and that type of thing, because there's just much more activity going on out there. Sorry, I keep hitting the wrong one. I wanted to give you some costs. As I said, we offer an incentive program. We offer $150 rebate. Well, a reimbursement for inspection of the sewer lateral and up to $2,000 for replacement or repair of the sewer lateral. We also cover all permit fees. And the cost for the first year were about $500,000. For the second year, almost $850,000. And we're on par to do about another $800,000 or $900,000 this year. This is a great program. We're really thrilled with it. We think it's targeting a really important part of our infrastructure. Even though we don't own it, the slide showing the causes of spills shows that this is an important cause of spills in our collection system. But it does represent a significant burden on our budget. We did raise rates cumulatively in 2 years by 2% each year to increase revenues to cover the cost of this program. That brings in about an extra $400,000 a year. So as you can see, that we are not quite covering the cost, and this does not include our staff costs. I haven't included any increased staff costs here. Effectively, what this means is that we're having to divert resources from other programs that we would normally be working on. However, as I said, I think it's the right place to be putting the resources. Our sewer laterals are typically not maintained. They can cause blockages in our sewer system, and they are the leading causes of blockages in our sewer system. That said, I'm going to get this button right sooner or later. That said, I think we need to make some revisions to that program. The problem caused by the plumbers have been the primary advocates of this program, although I do want to take a moment to acknowledge Channel Keeper and Heal the Ocean for their strong support and work with us in developing and implementing this program. They worked very collaboratively with us on this program, and we really appreciate their help and support. But the plumbers have been selling this program for us. And the plumbers, of course, are selling it because they want the business. And unfortunately, that's resulted in some situations where the property owner is a little bit out of the loop. So we're working right now to make revisions to our administrative procedures so that we will have direct interface with the property owners, and we can make sure that we have better control over the actions of plumbers and hopefully get rid of some of the unanticipated consequences of the sewer lateral repair program. The other things that we're doing, we continue our CCTV, closed caption television inspection program. We have a fairly aggressive program. 2 years ago, we inspected all of our pipes of 10 inches or greater, but most of our pipes are 8 inches or smaller, so we continue to inspect those on an ongoing basis. We have a brand new truck for that purpose with state-of-the-art equipment that allows us to get very good resolution and understanding of what's going on in our collection system. We have an ongoing preventative maintenance program. We clean over 200 miles of the collection system each year. And again, we have a brand new piece of equipment for that as well. And next year or the year after, we should be replacing our other hydrovactors. So we'll have two hydrovactors. One of our hydrovactors is really at the end of its life, and that has affected to some extent its availability. But with the replacement of it next year, we should be able to get even more preventive maintenance done. We're doing some system monitoring, and I'm going to talk about that in the next slide. And we continue with our program of rehabilitation and replacement of a portion of our system each year. And that has been very successful, and the way that we target the pipes for replacement is based on condition and age and how they performed. So we've been very successful at taking the worst performing pipes out of our system. And I'm pleased to say that our pipes that we're replacing are for maintenance problems, not for structural condition. So that's an important thing to note. The system monitoring. We are continuing to monitor our system for performance, particularly regarding to inflow and infiltration. We did a very comprehensive inflow and infiltration study across the city in 2003, and then, because it didn't rain, again in 2004. So we have excellent data that we are about how well our system performs in dry weather and in wet weather. We are using that data to target areas of the city, and you can see the highlighted portions are the areas that had higher than average inflow and infiltration. Last year, we took the basin down the bottom that says SP25 and did some additional targeted monitoring there to look for, to try and narrow down causes of the inflow and infiltration. And now, in the next couple of weeks, we're going to our council for authorization to do flow monitoring in each of the next 4 years in one additional basin. So that will really allow us to target our rehabilitation and replacement programs in those basins, as well as targeting our sewer lateral inspection work within those basins. And we used the INI study and the flow study to develop a very comprehensive model of our sewer system. And the model has shown us that under dry weather conditions, we have no capacity issues. Under wet weather conditions, we do have a few areas that have a potential to cause surcharge in rainfalls of greater than 10-year 24-hour return frequency. So that's what we would call a 10-year storm. But we don't have any locations within our system that would cause surcharge for a rainfall lower than that. And we are working to address those areas of limited sewer capacity during periods of surcharge and have accomplished three of these wet weather improvements, the most significant of which was installing a new line to relieve flows on a portion of our sewer system that was causing spills at a place called Spring Street. And that was installed in 2007, and we've been checking it since. It's performing beautifully. We've had a couple big rainstorms and no problems in that line whatsoever. Next week or the week after, we're expecting to do the last of these on the list, which is to upsize a pipe on a couple of blocks on De La Vina to relieve that area from potential for surcharge as well. So we are aware of I wanted to close with one of the things that, you know, you hear about the problems we have because that's usually what we're alerted to. But I also wanted to talk about one of our real successes. At 4 o'clock on a Thursday afternoon, Manuel Romero, our collection system superintendent, who's here with me, was sitting in the meeting room with his staff debriefing for the day, and they got a call saying a contractor had hit our 24-inch pipeline on Cabrillo Boulevard immediately across from the beach. So they mobilized and got out there and dug down and found, and this is below the water table. So the mud that you see in that second picture is groundwater. They found that the contractor had indeed hit and quite crushed this pipeline. This is an old pipeline. We didn't have any pipe. The exterior diameter of this pipeline replaced with new pipe doesn't match. So we had to get special calders from LA. We had crews out on the site for 70 hours working around the clock to make sure that we didn't have a spill from the site. And I'm very pleased to say that this is not in your INI overflow database, because we were completely successful here. And I think that really speaks to a testament to the interest in our city and our staff in really addressing these issues fully and comprehensively and trying to take care of them as comprehensively as we can. And I want to say one more thing that I missed on the monitoring. We are, in terms of trying to reduce overflows, we're realizing that we really need better monitoring of them before they occur, finding out where those stoppages are before they turn into overflows. And so we're pursuing a technology called Smart Covers that is a ultrasonic flow meter attached to the bottom of manholes that will alert us if there's an increase of the water level within the manhole, and hopefully will give us heads up enough that we can get out to those to a potential spill before it actually spills. We've just started looking into that. I don't expect to be going forward with that probably for the next 6 months, but we think it's a very promising technology. It's being used widely throughout the West Coast, particularly in the San Diego area, with really good success. So we're pursuing that as well. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any board questions? Okay.
I'll just
Mr. Briggs?
Add that you mentioned the repair or the replacement on Spring Street, and I remember that was a chronic problem area. It was living up to its name in terms of the sewer system being the source of a spring, I guess, unfortunately. So that's great news if you're able to get through significant rain events with that new pipeline performing so well. So that's very good to hear.
I'm curious, going back to the spill history, and then when you started to characterize your spills in the Category 1 and 2, before then, there wasn't the split in the categorization, so everything was just combined?
Prior to the progression of spill reporting, it has sort of increased. When Prop 65 was implemented, the threshold for spill reporting was 1,000 gallons or anything that made it to a waterway. In about 1994, the city adopted a policy of anything over 50 gallons. But we didn't, it's a little unclear how we interpreted that, whether that was anything out of over 50 gallons that wasn't recovered, or how we, you know, that was a voluntary policy that we adopted to make sure we were reporting spills. The most definitive policy for reporting spills, when we got our new MPDS permit, that had a requirement to report all spills but not to categorize them. It's the statewide WDR that has given us the most clear direction on how to report spills and has established the two different categories in order to try and determine, you know, differentiate the severity of the spill.
Then my question would be, why is it in 2007 and 8 there were such high numbers of Category 1 spills, unless I misread that slide?
Yeah, and Category 1 spills, remember, are spills
1,000 gallons or more that go to
a
waterway.
Or anything that makes it to a waterway. So they can be very small spills that make it to a waterway. And, in fact, most of our spills are very small spills. Do you know the number that we've had over 1,000? We've had 4 spills that exceeded 1,000 gallons, and at least one of those was wet weather related, so during a period of rainfall, which tends to be a bigger spill.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Should we go to our speakers?
Yes.
I don't have the card, so you'll have
I've got one here.
One card. Okay. Kira Redman, a Santa Barbara channel keeper.
Good morning, Chair Young, members of the board. I'm Kira Redmond, Executive Director of Santa Barbara Channel Keeper. My organization has been trying to get the City of Santa Barbara and this board to take meaningful action to address the unacceptable number of SSOs in Santa Barbara since 2003. I brought the problem to this board's attention again last year or possibly the year before, I can't recall. Yet the board has taken a wait-and-see approach. And what you see is that the number of SSOs continues to rise with each passing year. There were 25 spills in 2006, 45 in 2007, 50 in 2008, and 42 to date this year. The number of SSOs continues to rise despite the wet weather capacity improvements made by the city to relieve the chronic spills on Spring Street, the implementation of a lateral inspection program in 2007, and after the city updated its sewer system management plan in January 2008. Yet staff claims that Santa Barbara has an aggressive operation and maintenance program that should help to reduce SSOs, and as such recommends that you sit back and wait and see for another 2 years. In other words, do nothing, while unacceptable numbers of SSOs continue to send raw fecal matter into Santa Barbara's world-class beaches and creeks, threatening the health of the many surfers, swimmers, and divers who recreate in these waters every day. Santa Barbara has by far the highest rate of SSOs in our region, and it continues to rise with each passing year. What is it going to take for this board to act to address this unacceptable situation? The city's rehabilitation and replacement of 1% of its collection system a year with a capital improvement program budget of $750,000 is grossly inadequate given the age and poor condition of the system. Every SSO is a violation of the city's NPDES permit. Yet staff recommends that you continue to sit back and do nothing. I urge you to take a different approach. It's time for this board to take action about the unacceptably high rate of SSOs in the city of Santa Barbara. Mandate that the city increase its rehabilitation and replacement rate, allocate additional funds to its capital improvement program, and implement a more aggressive lateral inspection and repair program. At a minimum, issue an NOV and penalties for the numerous violations of the city's permit to provide an incentive to the city to address the problem. As the director of an organization that represents the strong interests of this community in clean water that's safe for recreation, I implore you to stop sitting back and waiting and act now to bring this serious public health issue under control. Thank you.
Any board comments or questions? Or Ms. Redmond? Okay. Mr. Briggs, this is just an informational.
Yes, and it's one that you requested. I think I'm in kind of a tough spot in terms of talking about enforcement action. We do have our enforcement coordinator here. If you have questions about how generally how enforcement cases are prioritized, especially within the category of spills and overflows. Stop me if I'm overstepping my bounds, Francis.
If The enforcement person can give a general discussion about priorities, but not specific to this city or this report, if you would like.
Well, let me just throw out the question. Does this discharger have the highest number of SSOs in the region? Can staff address that? And is that okay? Are you in agreement with the explanation for why that is?
No, it's they do have the most within our region. I think the way we look at it is one thing is impacts on water quality, actual impacts to surface water quality. They have had an increase of overflows in the last few years, but those have been in the Category 2 region, the ones that don't reach surface waters and that are smaller. Their actual Category 1 spills have stabilized over the last 5 years. In terms of looking at enforcement, it's we look at what the community is doing to correct the problems. Have you seen, they've identified what their main problem, the main source of the overflows, which is root intrusion. And they have the most, I could say, the most aggressive program within our region in terms of dealing with laterals. There are a few other communities in our region that do have lateral programs, but they don't go to the extent that the city of Santa Barbara does. They have the ability, when they see roots, to require an inspection, to require repair, and to correct the problem. One of the issues is they only have the ability to inspect through the closed circuit TV about 20 miles per year. So it takes a while to get through the system, and that's why we're recommending that we allow more time for the city to implement the program. As they make their way through the city, there should be a reduction in those overflows. But it's a 270-mile system, so at 20 miles a year, it will take a few years to get through that. They've already had 3 years to do that.
Well, Ryan, what's the estimate for when that should happen? In other words, how many more years of work should we then see a drop-off in SSOs?
That's a difficult question to answer. When you look at the spills geographically throughout the city, there is not a pattern of a specific area that has them. The city has a tremendous amount of trees, and it's an issue all over the city, and it's not one that when they go in and do a capital improvement in terms of replacing the main line, it doesn't get all the laterals that are problematic. So you can have a capital improvement program that's going around and replacing line and whatnot, but that won't get at that problem. That problem is through inspections and requiring repairs, also through the smoke testing and all the other programs they use to look at where there are broken lines.
Are the SSOs equally related to new line versus old line? Is there any correlation?
That I don't know. I don't have that information to determine.
Do you have that, Rebecca?
Yes, we are having problems with SSOs on recently rehabilitated pipes, and they are from sewer lateral roots going in from sewer laterals into the line. They are not from incursion directly into our pipes.
So I guess then the question would be, is the lateral inspection program aggressive enough?
The lateral program inspection program is very aggressive in terms of what we require of property owners. There are a couple of limiting factors. Our staff resources are somewhat limited, and the other thing is our ability to get the CCTV work done. We can and will consider a contract for CCTV where we can spit out a lot of work at one time. Problem is it usually takes us a while to catch up to get the work done by the property owners to fix the issues. The SLIP program is very labor-intensive for us. It takes a lot of one-on-one time with each property owner. So we're really putting a lot of effort into it.
Mr. Hodgen.
I wonder if you can comment on whether the high number of spills, a relative high number of spills, may have something to do with other jurisdictions being less diligent in reporting spills?
That would basically be speculative at this point. There are other systems with similar size that have a lot fewer spills, but at a staff level, we don't know necessarily unless we receive a call from a third party reporting a spill that we didn't receive from the municipality or the district. We don't know if they are under-reporting. I can tell you the city of Santa Barbara reports a lot of spills, a lot of small spills. I'm confident and comfortable that they're reporting all the spills that they have. But I can't speak to whether the other communities are. Within the CWIX database, which is the database that I used for the information in the staff report, not all communities have been reporting to that for the same amount of time. And I tried to explain that in the staff report, but that some communities and similar sized communities were enrolled in the general permit after the city of Santa Barbara had been reporting to that. So those levels might not be accurate in that database.
Dr. Hunter?
Thank you. Chair Young raised a question concerning the link between the stormwater management program and this particular issue. And I think Rebecca commented that this information is just taking shape, and so they will begin to explore that. But from staff perspective, where does this link in with stormwater management? I don't know if you can answer that, Ryan. I know you have a different area.
Yeah, I mean, it obviously impacts it when it gets into storm drains and whatnot, but they do have the ability to capture it when it is in the storm drain collection system and clean it during a dry weather incident. If it's in a wet weather situation, they don't have the ability to do that. I don't recall what the city of Santa Barbara's stormwater management plan, what that what it speaks to the overflows.
I think this one, the question was specifically with regard to construction sites. So that's where the link is for stormwater, but
right. I had never dealt with that when I was in the stormwater program in terms of material going in there, other than construction debris being intentionally put in, not situations where they're replacing or repairing a lateral and material is I would hope accidentally put into the system, into the main line, which can cause an overflow. Again, I think the majority of them, based on the city's information, is when they're not necessarily a construction site, but they're replacing the lateral, and I don't think that would qualify as a construction site under the stormwater program within the city, because it's not over a certain size. I don't know the specifics of the city's construction program, but at the state level, it's an acre or larger, and so when you're replacing a lateral, you're not going to get an acre of disturbance.
So, Rebecca, is that the source of the construction debris? Is it from the repair of laterals, or is it from construction sites?
Chair Young, it's primarily from the repair of laterals. Hmm. We can pretty closely link it to where we've had a repair done, and then we find a debris downstream. Sometimes some of the causes of overflows have been caused from debris downstream that we can fairly closely link to an upstream repair. We do have an ability to recover costs for those, and we do pursue costs for our response and cleanup where we can identify a cause of the overflow.
If I may, do you have repeat offenders with that problem?
Unfortunately, we do have some repeat offenders, and this is one of the issues that we're really trying to address in our sewer lateral inspection program administrative revisions, is trying to put some kind of quality control on the work of the plumbers. Unfortunately, we have some people who seem less professionally ethical than others, and we really want to have a way of letting the customers know that have some kind of heads up about past practices or past problems we've had with particular contractors. So we are working with our attorney's office to try and figure out how to put some kind of restriction on people who are qualified to do this work, but it's difficult because of the state contracting codes, and it's taking us a little bit of discussion about how to do that effectively.
That would be preventative, but in terms of repeat offenders where they've actually caused the problem, do you have the ability, and have you followed up with some actions against them?
The problem is that we have the ability to recover costs from the property owner. And the repeat offenders, you tend to be the contractor for the property owner, and so they aren't at the same property. They're, you know, as they move to different properties, they may cause the same problem, but they're at different locations, so we have to seek recovery from the property owner.
And that, you know, this is one of the reasons that we're trying to address and revise our administrative procedures so that the property owner doesn't end up being the victim of poor contracting practices by really a small number of contractors.
Okay.
And where do you get the biggest bang for your buck? Is it in the capital improvement area or the lateral inspection area? In other words, if you were to address spills, what helps the most?
In terms of expenditures, since we're paying a portion of the cost for replacement of the laterals, and although laterals are not publicly owned, because it's a gravity system, the system doesn't know any difference. If we have problems in our sewer system that are caused by those laterals, it has just the same effect. So we actually get a big bang for our buck by putting the money into the private laterals. The other thing is that, unfortunately, our system, we do inspect and repair it, and we have been doing so for a long period of time. Most people don't even know they have a sewer lateral. So inspection and repair is not on their horizon at all, and so it really improves the level of maintenance on those systems, you know, 100 times because they're not doing anything. And historically, most people, if they have a blockage on their lateral, they'll call their router person to come out and clean it out, and then the next year the same thing, and the next year the same thing until it absolutely fails. And this is an incentive for them to get it taken care of at the beginning of that system rather than the end.
Mr. Shallcross.
Is there a difference in the whether it's one of the lateral problems or your main system problem on the Category 1 spills? In other words, are more of the Category 1 spills from the laterals or from the other, or from your main system?
According to our collection system superintendent, Manuel Romero, they are primarily caused by private lateral root intrusion.
The Category 1?
Yes.
Okay, thanks.
Mr. O'Malley. Thank you. Now, I understand your annual budget is $750,000. Is that correct?
Our annual range of expenditure for collection system rehabilitation and maintenance is in our SSMP at $750,000. We have historically funded that more at $1.5 to $2 million. And that doesn't include the $800,000 creeping up towards $1 million that we're adding in towards our laterals. I want to put that in the context of our overall revenues in an annual year are $13 million. So the expenditures on the collection system are, and that doesn't include operations and maintenance. Our collection system capital expenditures are a substantial budget item.
Okay, and all of your cost recovery goes back into this program on top of anything that might be budgeted annually for maintenance?
Our cost recovery will go back to the wastewater fund. Unfortunately, it's more of a sort of please don't do this again than a significant source of income.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Okay. And a question for Mr. Packard, if he could just, in a general sense, without making any specific comments, I think some are interested in, you know, enforcement, but I guess the first question is, are SSOs a violation of a permit?
Right. My name is Harvey Packard. SSOs are a violation of at least one permit, and that's the statewide general order for sanitary sewer systems, the SSO order. It could also be violations of the individual facility permits. So potentially one order, potentially two orders. But as far as how we prioritize or decide what actions to take enforcement on, we look at a couple things. And first of all is the individual violation itself. If it's a big spill and has effects on the environment or the population, that obviously is something that we look at importantly or critically and could cause us to raise the priority of it. We also look at patterns. So if there's a facility or an agency that has a pattern of a lot of violations or a lot, or maybe not a lot, but a smaller number of larger violations, that would cause us to take a closer look. The last two enforcement actions that I recall that we took enforcement on or for spills were one for the CMC facility where they had a fairly large spill that went into Toro Creek, which is an important water body that went into the Morro Bay, also sensitive water body. And the second one was the city of Arroyo Grande, where they had a fairly large spill that made it all the way to the ocean and caused a beach closure. So those are the types of things that are that make it high on the priority list and that we take the effort to take enforcement action on.
So in the first permit or order that you mentioned, is that that's a statewide permit, what are the requirements for tripping a penalty?
There's no language in there about what will happen. It's just a violation, and then it's up to the board to determine what the appropriate enforcement would be.
Well, but the board never sees it unless the enforcement staff decides
right.
to do
yeah,
something
about it. I meant the board in general, including staff. And what you see are the individual listings in each agenda
right.
of violations, and then you'll see the enforcement action itself if the enforcement team decides that it's high enough priority to take some action on.
What about for a notice of violation? What generally are you looking for?
Before we send a notice of violation?
Right.
It's, again, it'd be a fairly significant issue. Trying to think of any we may have sent lately for those, but it's not, you know, notice of violation is the lower level of enforcement, but it's still, again, not something that happens a lot for spills. It'll happen on significant spills or significant number of spills.
Okay.
If the enforcement policy goes through somewhat similar to where it is now, is that necessarily going to trigger more enforcement actions? Because, as I recall, it's providing guidance in terms of amounts
right.
where the enforcement team decides that they're going to proceed with administrative civil liability,
right.
but may not necessarily say this is where you have to have administrative civil liability.
No, I don't think it necessarily will. The enforcement policy, the current enforcement policy, has a set of criteria that we use to determine whether we call a priority or we call a violation a priority violation. And a priority violation deserves more scrutiny, not necessarily an enforcement action, but it puts it automatically on our priority list. And I'm not familiar enough with the new proposed policy to remember if it has a different way of ranking those priority violations. But I don't think it will automatically trigger more enforcement.
Now. Right.
Okay. I guess my final questions then would be for the city.
Thanks, Harvey.
Thank you, Mr. Packard. Is the city's strategy for this to continue their current level of funding in the capital improvement program as well as the lateral inspection program, and just kind of hoping that at some point we're going to see a drop in these spills?
Mr. Chair, our strategy is to continue the current level of funding, if possible. And I have to say that our treatment plan is 30 years old. It has significant reconstruction needs and capital improvement needs that are becoming increasingly critical. And we have a fixed level of revenues. We do have a program of raising our rates every year, 3.5%, to keep up with increasing costs, but primarily to fund increasing capital needs. We've been pretty successful in making changes to our operating strategy to reduce operating costs, particularly in the areas of energy conservation. So the increases are primarily going to increase capital needs. In the last couple of years, not now, but in the last couple of years, we saw construction costs skyrocket. Right now is a good bidding environment, but our money wasn't going as far as it was for a couple of years there. And we do have some significant needs at our treatment plant that we also have to balance with the needs in the collection system. So the long answer is we will continue to increase our capital funding. However, we need to balance that between the collection system and the treatment plant. We have got a long-term commitment to collection system rehabilitation and renewal.
What are your own estimates for when the spill level should drop off?
I'm optimistic that having monitoring, which is a brand new tool in the collection system, may provide us with some reduction in the spills. If that's the case, then hopefully we'll see that within the next 6 months. If we get a period of wet weather, that will give us some relief as well. This dry period has really increased the number of root problems that we see. So in terms of making a forecast, I'm not sure exactly when we'll get start to see it go down again, but we are working hard towards that direction. Mm.
So no one has actually done any computations or calculations?
Because the spills that we're seeing are not repeat, we have no repeat spills. Mm. They're randomly occurring throughout our 277 miles of line. And one other complicating factor for the city is that a significant portion of our sewer lines are in easements, which means they're not under roadways where they're actually going through people's yards, which makes it, one, harder to access them, but, two, much more available to root intrusion. Mm. So, you know, I think it's going to continue to be a challenge to operate this collection system. And I think in that case, we really need to expand our palette of tools to look at some increased monitoring and notification to give us that as well.
Okay. Mr. Briggs.
If I heard actually both you and Ryan Lodge correctly, it sounded like a bottleneck, if you'll pardon the term, is the capacity of the closed circuit television in terms of the rate that you can cover per year, and you mentioned the possibility of contracting for assistance there.
I think the bottleneck for in terms of actually effectively, if we CCTV, and we did do extensive amount of CCTV work in 2008 on our larger diameter pipes, and we still have the backlog of work to clean and repair from that. So, you know, our resources in terms of our staffing are a limitation. We are well staffed. We have a staff of 17 people for the collection system, which is fairly good for a collection system our size, as well as well equipped. We have two hydrovactors, a rotter, a flusher, a television van, and numerous other pieces of equipment. It is a labor-intensive process to get through our system. We also rely heavily on private contractors to do point repairs and assist us in our construction maintenance of our system. So we put a lot of resources at it. It's just a lot of actually fairly small pipes that can block fairly quickly.
Okay.
And in terms of addressing the private lateral issue, the SIP program is very resource intensive, and so getting private property owners to respond to that, you know, there is some kind of, that's, I think if we wanted to really focus, that's where the bottleneck would be in implementing our SLIP program, our sewer lateral inspection program.
Mr. O'Malley.
Well, I live in a community that values trees and landscaping probably somewhat, not as much as Santa Barbara maybe, and I know that it can be a lot of cost related to working around landscaping and trees and maybe special permitting required if you wanted to remove a tree and or hand digging around root systems. And I don't know what degree any permitting or costs are associated with that. I assume you're not including those costs with lateral repair costs, or is that factored in into, and to what degree do those maybe potential catch-22 rules might be in your community impact this lateral repair?
Our community is very tree friendly. We are a tree city, have been for I think several decades. And lateral placement repair and pipeline replacement and repair really isn't dependent on tree removal. What we need to do is put in seamless pipes that have no breaks, that don't allow an opportunity for the roots to get into them.
And do you have any extra requirements in terms of hand trenching around root systems when you're replacing laterals, or any extra requirements that might be involved with this replacement process?
We really don't have any special requirements on us, particularly on private property, where there are city street trees involved. We want to make sure there's not damage to city street tree roots, but it doesn't add substantially to the cost or difficulty in implementing the program.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Any other board comments or questions? What perhaps we could do maybe is next year, if we're back in Santa Barbara, maybe we can have a status report from the city.
Okay.
Other than that, I know Channel Keeper was asking us to encourage or direct some type of enforcement, but the board does not get involved in enforcement. We've got a separation of powers requirement.
Well, you get involved, but as the judge.
Exactly. As the judge. And so the judge can't tell the prosecutors what to do whatsoever. So, and this applies to everything regarding enforcement. If people have an issue that they think requires some type of enforcement action, they have to take it up with the enforcement team. And that's Mr. Packard, who is here. And that's the focus of the request and the inquiry. But the board itself just sits back and responds to enforcement actions as they're brought to the board. So that's where that lies. So I want to thank everybody for their participation in this, and to the city and everyone else. And we'll move on to the next agenda item.